The blade struck the man's neck, cleaved right through it, and buried itself in the wooden platform below. The screaming stopped. My breath tasted of sick. I was panting and terrified as the mayor approached me. He leaned close, and I braced for some form of punishment for doing such a horrible thing.
"Well done," the mayor said. "Well done indeed. What a show. What a piece of butchery. The point has well been made."
He shoved several hard-edged coins into my hand and then walked over to the edge of the platform. The crowd cheered, and I yanked my axe free and made my escape. But everywhere I turned, the crowd shoved coppers into the pockets of my cape, and the guards smacked me on the back and smiled. When I turned the corner from the square, I leaned over a gutter, pulled the hood up as far as I dared, and threw up until my stomach hurt. How could my father have done this for days on end, during the first purges, when blood had flooded these same gutters? Afterward, I looked down and opened the clenched fist I had made with my free hand. 4 pieces of silver gleamed back at me from the blood-soaked hand. I wanted to toss them into the stinking gutter. But then, where would that leave my family? Slowly I began to make my way toward the poverty of Lesser Kyme. It was only as I approached the mayor's bridge that the clatter of guards sweeping past me over the bridge shook me from my stupor. They shoved past me, rushing. I tried to see who they were pursuing. Instead, across the river, I saw rising smoke. Raiders, close to home. I rushed across the bridge, fighting against the fleeing crowd seeking safety in Kyme. A screaming man smacked into me. His left arm dangled uselessly, crushed. We both fell to the ground, and he scrabbled up.
"Damn you," I grunted. "What are you doing?" "Raiders," he shouted at me. "Run for your life. Pikens have come again."
I sat up, pulling the axe close to me, and looked down the street. More smoke seeped into the tight alleyways between buildings, and I could hear screams in the distance. The streets were filling with people moving quickly for the river, their eyes darting about, expecting attackers in every shadow and around every alley.
"They're here to burn us to the ground," the man said.
He was originally from Turris. I could hear it in his accent. He seemed to be looking far away, maybe reliving the horrors of the raider attacks that forced him to come all the way to Lesser Kyme. It wouldn't all burn, not unless the water brigades failed to put out the fires. The raiders started them to distract everyone while they smashed, looted, and stole. Then they took off just as quickly as they appeared, leaving the stunned warrens of Lesser Kyme behind. People jostled past us, a moving river of humanity headed for the riverbanks. "Where are they going?" I asked. "They would drown in the river if the raiders got this far, or stumble into bramble along the banks."
"Away,"
the man said, and ran off with them. I pushed through the oncoming crowds. They split apart for an executioner, and if they did not, I used the bronze-weighted butt of the axe to shove them aside. 5 streets from the river, I had to turn away from my usual route home. Smoke choked the street, black and thick, and it spat people out, who coughed and collapsed to the dirt, gasping for air.
"They set fire to the slums! Don't go down there!"
a woman with a flower-covered apron shouted at me. I ignored her and ran through alleyways. I pushed through the doors of empty houses and climbed through windows to make my way around the burning sections of town, slowly getting closer to home. I ran past several burning wrecks of the small farms of the lesser estates, my boots raising dust with each step. I could see the gnarled trees behind my house, writhing in flame. And as I scrambled painfully over the stone wall, I saw the timbers give way and the roof fall in on itself. The heat forced me back when I tried to run inside. I paced around the house like a confused animal. Stone cracked from the heat, a and a screaming wail came from within. I ripped my hood off and shoved it into one of my pockets so I could breathe.
Jaram! I cried. Set!
A blazing figure erupted from the front door, leaping onto the dusty ground and rolling around until the flames were extinguished. It was Anto. His blackened form lay by my feet, rasping in pain. I dropped to my knees. Where are Jaram and Set?
It hurts, Anto whimpered.
I shook him.
Where are my children?
But he was too sunk in his own pain to answer. I turned to the burning house and tried to rush inside, but the building collapsed. An explosion of fire and smoke shoved me back. I fell to the ground, sobbing my despair, ashamed of my failure to save my children. The house continued to burn. I had taken a man's life. Now mine was being taken from me.
It hurts,
Anto groaned, intruding on my grief.
Please.
I stared up at the house. Jaram and Set.
With Jorda.
He looked up at me, eyes startlingly white against the blackened face, begging,
please.
The smell of burned flesh filled my lungs.
You can't ask me. Please,
he whispered. So I used the axe for the second time that day. I found Jorda's body under the tree where he had been drinking. There was an arrow through his neck and a wineskin by his feet. Drunkard, he may have been. A disappointment to Anto, this was true. But the dirt was scuffed with footmarks. Small footmarks. He'd tried to protect my sons. I kissed the three rings on my hand and prayed to Mara that my sons were alive, and as I did so, saw the scraped dirt of Set's dragged foot, next to the hoof marks leading off down the dirt road. With an apology to Jorda's lifeless body, a whisper of thanks to Mara, I got up and began to follow the tracks, the executioner's axe gripped tight in both hands. The burned remains of Lesser Kaim's southern fringe faded away into the rocky hills of sparse grass and clumps of bramble as the day passed. Weariness spread through my knees, and the miles wore at me as I doggedly moved southward. I ploughed on. I had to move faster, not pick my way around bramble if I hoped to catch the raiders. I had to hope the leather apron would also help protect me from the bramble's malevolence. At the crest of a hill scattered with boulders, I looked back at the many burning buildings of Lesser Kaim. Tiny figures formed a line by the river, passing along buckets of water to try and douse denser areas of town. The outer sections contained many black skeletal building frames. I turned from it all, walking down the other side of the hill, the axe weighing heavier and heavier. At the bottom of the hill, turning onto the old cobblestone ruins of Junpavati Road, I caught up to the raiding party. The men rode massive barrel-chested war horses that looked like they could pull an oxen's plough. They held their long spears in the air like flagpoles, and their brass helmets glinted as they rode alongside a mass of humanity being herded south like sheep. Somewhere in that sad, roped-together crowd were my sons. I wondered how many other townsmen had tried to fight the raiders, and how many lay dead on the dirt roads of Lesser Kaim with pitchforks or knives in hands. I stared at the raiders. Only four of them had been left to march their captives along. No doubt the rest had ridden on ahead. Four trained men. And me. I would die, I knew. But what choice did I have? They were ripping my family away. What person would run from their own blood? I killed already today, I thought, hefting the executioner's axe. I was dizzy from exhaustion, and the mild poison of the few bramble threads that had poked through my leggings threatened to drop me into bramble sleep. But I made my decision and moved toward the raiders. As I did so, I pulled the executioner's hood back over my face to protect myself from the taller clumps of bramble drooping off the rocks. I used the rocks and boulders of the dead landscape to get close to the raider trailing the column of prisoners. I was stunned by how large the man's warhorse was. When its hooves slammed into the ground, I could feel them from 20 feet behind. The hems of my cloak brushed bramble as I ran at the man's back, and the horse whinnied as it sensed me. The raider spun in his saddle, spear swinging down in an arc as he looked for what had spooked the horse, and he spotted me. He realized I was inside the spear's reach, and he leaped off his horse to avoid the first high swing of my axe at his thigh, putting the horse between us. I ran in front of the giant beast to get at him, but before I could even raise the axe again, he attacked. His red cloak flared out behind him and the spear lashed out. I was slow, but I dodged the point. In response, the man flicked it up and smacked the top of my head with the side of the shaft.
"And what do you think you're doing?" the raider demanded.
He sounded unhurried and calm. "You stole my family," I said, as my knees buckled from the blow to the head. I fought to stand and wobbled slightly. Hoofbeats thudded behind me. The raider used the spear to hit me on the side of my head before I could even raise the axe to try and block the movement. His movements would have been too fast for me, even if I hadn't been tired from chasing them or my blood filled with bramble poison. The blow dropped me to the ground, blood running down over my eyes inside the hood, blinding me.
"What do we have here?"
a second raider voice asked, as feet hit the ground. My hood was ripped clear of my head. The two raiders bent over me, dark eyes shadowed by their bronze helmets, spears pinning my cloak and me to the ground. I blinked the blood out of my eyes and waited for death.
"It's a woman," the raider I'd attacked said. "That's quite plain," said the other. "Should we kill her or take her with us? She's too old to go to the camps or to sell."
The other raider nodded.
"So we kill her? She doesn't need to be part of the culling," the older sounding raider said.
He shook his head.
"No, she's too old to have children. She's no threat. Cripple her so she can't follow us, then leave."
The older raider remounted his horse and left. The remaining raider and I stared at each other, and then he reversed his spear.
"The way of the six says that we should..."
I spat at him. The effort dizzied me.
"I don't care about your damned way of the six, slaver. Do what you came to do."
He shrugged and slammed the butt of his spear into my ankle, crushing it. As I screamed, he smacked my head. I fell back away, down into a patch of bramble, some of which pierced my clothing. The bramble threads stuck to my skin, calling me down to sleep. It was enough to easily drag me away from the world. 2. To my shock, I woke up with a grunt in the dark, something creaking and swaying beneath me. I'd been dreaming about a younger Set, his large brown eyes looking into mine as he struggled so hard to stumble about, learning to walk. He'd fallen and I'd rushed out, shouting at him to be careful, and then I had woken up. I felt for my forehead, but there was no pain or bump as I expected. My ankle felt fine. I felt fine, except for the extreme slowness that remained with me from the bramble sleep. I'd brushed against it once before, as a child. My parents had found me staggering about in the backyard and pulled the bramble threads from my skin carefully with tweezers. People fretted over me for nearly a week as I lingered on the edge of darkness. I licked my dried lips and sat up. The world kept creaking back and forth. I heard wheels turning underneath me. I was inside a covered wagon of some sort. Daylight peeked through cracks in wooden walls and top, and I could taste fish and salt hanging in the air. A bird screeched outside, and I realized I must be near the coast. My axe lay near me, as did my leather hood, which meant I was somewhere safe. In a daze, I crawled toward a large flap, and as I reached it, a hand flung it aside, blinding me with daylight.
"Well, hello there," someone said gently. "I was just coming to check on you."
My eyes watered as if they hadn't seen sunlight in weeks. Strong hands gripped my arm.
"Careful, or you'll fall off."
I sat on the back of a large wagon. A small deck ran around the rim of the vehicle. A woman my age, traces of gray in her hair, held my arm. Her trader tattoos, including a striking purple figure of the elephant god Sisinak, holding the triple scales of commerce, ran up and down her forearms.
"I'm a Nezca," she said.
She squatted on the platform, jutting off the back.
"I was bringing you some soup. Everyone's going to be excited to hear you woke up."
I moved out onto the platform with a Nezca, still amazed that my ankle wasn't hurting. Another wagon trundled along behind the one I woke up on, pulled by four massive aurochs. They looked like cattle, but far more muscular. Their long horns swooped well out before them like the prows of ships. Four aurochs also followed the back of the wagon I was on, resting from the strain of pulling. Their flanks rippled and hooves thumped the ground as they all plodded along. Behind the wagon following us was another, and then another, and then another yet again. I counted 10 before the long train of wagons curved around a bend in a fine cloud of kicked-up dust. Each wagon featured its own unique, mottled, purple and green painted patterns on their wooden sides. Many had carved depictions of markets, roads, and maps of the world, all expertly chipped into their sides.
"This is a caravan," I said out loud, realizing it at the same moment I spoke it.
"This is the caravan," Anezka said. "You're traveling the spice road on the perpetual caravan. We move along the coast, starting in Pica, and go all the way to Mimestiva, and even a little beyond, until the bramble of the east stops us with its wall. Then we turn back around again. There used to be many, all throughout the old empire. Now, only us."
Mimestiva was on the coast, hundreds of miles from Kaim. Pica lay on the coast as well, far to the west. I knew of a few who'd visited Mimestiva. These were cities that to me were almost past the edge of the known world.
"You said that people would be excited I was awake," I said.
Anezka's eyes widened.
"Because you're the Lady Executioner, who met four Pikens in mortal combat. Everyone's been talking about you up and down the line."
"I didn't fight four," I said with a frown.
"I only took on one and he beat me badly.
But yes, there were four of them." I looked down at my ankle.
"How long have I been asleep?" "You should see the roadmaster," Anezka said.
"Why is that?" I asked.
"Because this is his wagon and you are his guest," Anezka said,
somewhat formally but quite firmly. With her arm to steady me, I grabbed the ropes along the outside of the covered wagon's rim, and we walked toward the front. As we approached the raised platform from where the aurochs were controlled, I could see up the line of the caravan. We were near the front. Muscled men with brass arquebuses stood on a 15-paces-long war wagon in front of us, with hammered metal shield walls protecting them. Farther ahead, a wagon with a large fire crew burned bramble away from the road edges, the roar of the flame carrying back over the air to us. The stench of the burned limbs wafted past. I was a long way from Lesser Kaim. The roadmaster was a mountain of a successful rich man, robes draped across the heft of his belly. But if I thought him jolly, that was a mistake. His smile was tight, controlled, and his eyes shrewd. This man saw more miles pass under the wheels of his home in a year than most ever traveled in a life. and judging by the lines in his face, he'd had a long life doing this. Like an Ezka, trader tattoos ran up and down his forearms, and his ears dangled from his ears. He had no moustaches. His lips were shaved clean, like a refugee from Alakan. I'd heard tales of the caravan and the coastal spice route. Townsmen who travelled south to markets were told tales of the great market of Mimistiva by other townsmen who ventured that far south. And here I was, sitting on a wagon with the roadmaster of the caravan himself.
"Welcome to the spice road," the roadmaster said with a twitch in the corner of his lips.
He did not hold the reins himself. That was done by a young man in a loincloth with massive arms who sat nearby. The thick leather straps that led to the aurochs were draped across his lap. The driver watched the road like an owl, his eyes never blinking. "Thank you," I said, and moved to sit by him. Perching higher than the bramble along the road meant that a soft sea breeze cooled my skin. From here I could see the road stretching out along the rocky coastline before us. The ocean, hundreds of feet below, slammed and boomed against the wall of brown rock. And out beyond the spray, the green waves surged around pinnacles of rock, shaped like the spires of castles. And beyond the spray and foam, the sea stretched out forever, flat, unbreaking, the color of wintergreen leaves.
"It is a beautiful sight," the roadmaster said, noticing my gaze.
"I never thought I'd see it in my life," I whispered. I wondered if Duram or Set had seen this as they were being marched west. I leaned forward to hide my face in my grief, and the roadmaster leaned close and touched my shoulder.
"What is your name, Lady Executioner?"
"Tana," I swallowed. "Tana the Lost. Tana the Homeless. Tana the Abandoned. But not Tana the Lady Executioner. I'm not that thing."
"I am Jal," he said softly. "Where are you from, Tana?"
"Kaim," I told him, and then I corrected myself. "Lesser Kaim."
"Ah, Kaim,"
he nodded.
"I think I remember Kaim from when I was just a boy. I was still sitting on my father's lap when he led the last caravan through. Sometimes I think I remember the start of that journey, or the greater cities of the Janparan Empire. I know I remember seeing a great palace that had fallen to earth, tilted, its foundational plane shattered like a plate, and the bramble, it gripped the city like a giant's fist, it did."
My grief broke a little, hearing his memories.
"You are that old?"
Jal laughed at me.
"I am that old, yes. Hopefully old enough that I'll die before I lose the title of roadmaster to the title of bushmaster, which is what they will call me when even the spice road on this coast becomes choked by damned bramble."
I looked out on the road and thought about what came next.
"Where do you head?"
"Pika," the roadmaster said. "And you will too."
He said this so firmly, I jerked to stare at him.
"What do you mean?"
"The men who delivered you here said you attacked four Pikans on your own. They said you demanded your family back and fought to the near death. So I have to imagine that a person who did that would not then turn around and head back to where she came from."
As he spoke, he turned and looked at me with a larger smile. "They'll not be going back to Lesser Kaim," I agreed.
"The men who brought you to me thought so. Pika is the greatest city in the west, and where your family most probably will be taken. And Pika is a carefully guarded city. You cannot enter without an examination and papers and a writ, unless you are like me and have dispensation. The Pikans fear people like you coming in to try and find their families. Yes, a person who attacks four of them would go to Pika with someone like me who could get you inside, I think."
I shook my head in frustration. "I didn't attack all four of the Pikans. The stories are wrong.
Of course they are. They're always wrong. Stories are for the listener, Tana. And it is what the listener makes of them that truly matters. The captured men who saw you attack the Pikens, they told us they found their courage. If one woman could attack four horsemen, then they could do the same. For 2 days and two nights they plotted and then finally attacked.
I couldn't believe what I heard. But it had to be true, didn't it? Or I wouldn't be here. And they succeeded?
They killed three of the Pikens and took their gold, their weapons, and their horses. Then one of them rode back to find you, where you were deep in the clutches of Bramble Sleep.
How long? I asked. Jarl waved a hand at me and ignored the question.
When I saw them outside Mimastiva, they had you on a travoy pulled behind a horse. They wanted to ride back to their homes along the coast as fast as they could without being slowed down. So they gave me a captive pike and horseman in exchange for food and coin for us to take care of you. We will ransom the raider back to Pika for good coin.
Up ahead the aurochs plodded forward. The wagon groaned and creaked along. How long have I been asleep? I asked again, fearing the worst.
3 weeks, I think. Maybe a month. We made bets to Dacre on whether you would wake. You are lucky to return to us. Even luckier that the man who picked up your body to bury it with honors heard you still whispering in your sleep.
I rubbed my arms. Whispering?
Names, I was told. Those close to you.
Family, I said, feeling the loss once again. Would it be possible to find my family then after a month? Or would they be scattered to even stranger lands? I bit my lip and looked at Jarl. The stories I have heard say the caravan is an expensive place to ride. Wherever I am, you can't carry any goods for trade, right?
What are you asking for the price of my passage?
I asked that, while fearing the worst.
I'm not after your body, Jarl muttered. The coin and the prisoner your inspired friend gave me for your safety is enough. Or we would have left you asleep by the side of the road weeks ago. But you are right. No one in the caravan lies around. Well, unless they're in a bramble sleep. I will move you to another wagon and you will work. Everyone in the caravan helps the caravan. That is our way.
I was relieved. In Lesser Kai, Jarl held up a hand to stop me.
Our needs are different from a town's. I don't care what you used to do. The caravan is a new life for you until we reach Pika. And Ezka says we need cooks in the lagging wagons to the rear, or firewood scroungers. We need hagglers and movers with the trading teams, inventory managers to make sure nothing is being stolen.
Now it was my time to interrupt. I thought about my fight with the raiders and about the future I was now thrown into. I was in a strange new land, and as Jarl said, starting a new life. I pointed at the wagon ahead of the fire crew. Those men, with the arquebuses. Let me join them. I want to learn how to use those weapons. In Kaim there are just a handful of those weapons, in the careful guard of the Jolly Mayor, and here you have a team armed with them. It is very impressive.
Jarl made a face. Impressive? The magisters of Jandpara would call down rocks from the skies and fly over their enemies to rain fire on them. That was impressive. These things are just loud tubes.
I'm sorry, I said.
No, I suppose you are right. The arquebus would be an interesting weapon for a lady.
And I could see the word executioner lurk behind his lips, but then falter as I stared coolly at him.
For you to wield, he corrected himself.
I looked at the road, curving off into my future, filled with ruts and ropes of bramble. Jarl, the caravan goes all the way to Pika, then back to Mimastiva. You trade with them?
Of course. I am a man of trade, the roadmaster said, slapping the tattoos on his forearms.
I work with anyone willing to pay a fair price for my goods and leave me to the Spice Road. But my allegiance is to no single city. Most of us abandon such loyalties after years on the road as cities rise and fall, come and go. Many of the families on the caravan have always been in the caravan, and will never rest until they reach the halls of Sisinak. If Borzai wills it, and your life's trades have been judged honest, it is only there they will rest in the oasis markets, where the goods are never scarce, and the gold in your purse refills every night.
Jarl chuckled. So you are no friend of the Pykans?
I am no one's friend. I am a trader, Jarl said. If you doubt me, go see the Pykan chained away in our wagon. He will remain there until we get to his city and I negotiate a good price for his freedom.
I may well do that, I said. Jarl raised his hands and clapped them together.
So, you want to use an arquebus? I will humor you. Boydan, come here.
One of the warriors looked back at us, set his arquebus down, then swung over the shields to drop to the road. He waited for the roadmaster's wagon to approach, then climbed easily up onto the deck by us.
Yes?
He was tall, with curled hair and a thick moustache. A massive scimitar hung on his left hip.
This is Tana, the Lady Executioner. She will work with you to protect the caravan.
Boydan looked me up, then down.
She is a woman, he said. Your powers of observation are astounding, Boydan. It's a damned shame you aren't in charge of accounts or haggling. Yes, she's a woman. It is plain for you and me to see. She is the woman who took on 4 Pykan soldiers by herself. Can you say the same?
Again, Boydan regarded me.
Whatever you want, Roadmaster. You're correct, Boydan. It is whatever I want. Take her back to a wagon with space to sleep and teach her what she needs to know. And get out of my sight. By all the damned halls, get out of my sight.
Boydan smiled. This was banter for them, the bluster that men exchanged. He turned around.
Let's go, Tana.
Jarl cleared his throat.
Oh, and tell Anezka that Tana will not be joining them at the rear of the caravan to help out. She will be disappointed, I'm sure, but she is a capable manager and will carry on.
I looked back at Jarl. Thank you.
Good luck.
And he seemed to think about something, then smiled and said,
Executioners.
I shook my head and went back to fetch my things. When Boydan later saw my axe with the black stains in the handle, he nodded and smiled widely. The muscular warrior and I stood, our backs to scrub, rock and bramble, and waited for the caravan to pass us by. Do you know anything about the raiders? I asked.
The Pykans?
Boydan spat.
Dogs! All of them!
I liked the large man better for the reaction. They took my family.
They all but owned the coast and more ever north, though I thought they would avoid the Blue City, what with your Magister Skax and all we hear about him. Ask Jarl sometime about the Pykans. He'll piss himself complaining about the extortions they rip from him to allow him to keep trafficking the Spice Road.
If anything, they've increased their raids, I told him. They burned my home.
They call what they do the Culling. They believe it is their holy duty. You're lucky to live. They go after young women and children. Eliminate the breed cows, they say.
I stared at him. How do you know all this?
Their preachers are all over Mimastiva these days, Boydan said. Things will get worse in the east now.
Why do they do it? I asked. What bizarre blasphemy did they preach?
They blame us for the bramble, Boydan said,
and pointed at a small wagon with a single auroch pulling it.
The surviving Pycon of the four you faced is in that wagon.
I cut him off. I keep saying this and no one listens to me. I didn't face all four of them. It was just one, and he knocked me to the ground easily. They hobbled me and left me.
Boydan nodded as we watched the wagon pass. For a moment I thought about swinging aboard and using my axe to kill the man inside. But Boydan saw the thought crossing my face, and he smiled.
Don't think about sneaking off in the night to come and kill him. Jarl will know it was you, and you wouldn't want to experience his anger if he were to lose his ransom.
Better not to endanger my chance of getting to Pyka, I thought. As the wagon passed on, I saw a glimpse of a figure sitting behind iron bars, his back to the world. I didn't recognize him as one of the two Pycons I'd seen. How long until we get to Pyka? I asked.
5 weeks, maybe six. The caravan is slow.
Boydan folded his arms.
We'll find you a place to sleep and get your axe sharpened up. And then I guess I'm the one stuck training you so that the next time you decide to take on a group of Pycons, you might at least kill one of them.
For the next 2 days, Boydan set me to walking alongside the caravan to get my feet back under me. We passed through more scrub and rock on the cliffs, and during those 2 days began to move downhill, even closer to the ocean as the land sloped. We passed coves of sand, nestled in between the scallops of coast. My ankle was somewhat tender, and at night I'd walk back to the wagon near the very end of the caravan and curse the pain. But by the third day it was a dull ache, and Boydan let me up into the guard wagon as we eased past a tiny fishing village perched over the ocean. Fishermen in rags raced up foothills, loudly hawking dried fish hanging from poles on their backs. I noticed none of the other men on the guard wagon would look me in the eye. I could feel that they resented my being there. We stood higher than all the caravan here, and I could see the five other guard wagons scattered throughout the snake-like convoy behind us.
We used to have scouts running out ahead, beside, and lagging behind, Boydan told me. But Jarl cannot afford it any more, so we must be more vigilant than ever.
As he said that, he looked around at the villagers to our side that pressed close to the wagons, shouting and trying to barter as the caravan stolidly moved on. I pointed at the gilded, brass-worked arquebus Boydan had over his shoulder. But what about that? Isn't it a good weapon?
All weapons are good, if used properly, Boydan said.
He handed me the device.
It is loud, and almost anyone can use it with some training. It sends bandits scurrying well enough.
It was heavy and clumsy in my hands. I looked down the long barrel, its surface etched with thin, serpentine dragons. I want to learn how to use this properly. He smiled. I learned how to pour the powder, light the matchlock, and raise the arquebus to the side of the shield wall to balance the ever-heavy barrel. Powder was expensive, so Boydan drilled me for the day without it. Over and over again I mimed putting in powder, putting in shot, tamping, then setting the gun on the ledge and aiming. I did it until my shoulders were sore.
Look past the barrel, Boydan urged, to your target. That tree, right over there. They are not accurate like a crossbow or arrows, but you should still make the effort to aim.
This time the gun was loaded, the acrid burning match, pinched between the serpentine lock, had been pulled back and was ready to strike. All I had to do was pull the trigger, and the burning fuse would descend into the pan.
Okay, fire it, Boydan said.
I did, and the world exploded in light and smoke.
Sons of whores! I shouted, startled. And when the smoke cleared, I saw a mess of shredded leaves and some broken branches far to the right of where I had aimed, and my shoulder hurt.
Boydan's men laughed at me.
It's got a kick, yeah?
But Boydan didn't laugh.
Clean it. Get a new one in, try again, same tree.
I reloaded rapidly, but not quick enough. The tree was almost obscured by the roadmaster's wagon by the time I set the barrel on the shield wall. Boydan grabbed it.
That was not bad, but not quick enough. So let's not shoot our employer with a stray shot today. Shoot that tree.
I aimed at our sides again, and this time I was expecting the unholy roar of the weapon. Smoke burned my face, and tears stung my eyes, but pieces of shot had fanned out and hit the tree I'd aimed at.
Good, Boydan said.
And then it was back to walking alongside the caravan for me. In the second week, after more drills, Boydan decided I could handle the arquebus well enough. We had left the coastal cliffs long behind us and wound our way through soft plains near the ocean's edge. Trees and farther inland woods began to hem the road we travelled on, not just bramble and brush.
You know as much as us about the arquebus, he said. Now it's time to think about close quarters. I will teach you to use your axe.
For this, we left the caravan, once I'd retrieved the executioner's axe. We walked out into the woods as the wagons slowly rumbled past. Boydan came with his scimitar, which was always at his side, and a small round shield he'd taken from the wagon's wall. He looked me up and down.
You may think that because you are a woman you are not a match for my men in the caravan. But if a 100-pound warrior came to me, I would not turn him away merely because my men weigh twice what he does. I would, however, have to understand how best to use him. He is a tool. Some tools are large and heavy, useful for clubbing and smashing things. Some are thin daggers, useful for stabbing quickly.
This was the longest thing I'd heard him say, and it sounded carefully thought out, like a speech. Did you think of how you would say this all last night as you sat sentry? I asked him.
Shut up. There are hard lands we will pass through, and we will be attacked, and you will protect the caravan.
He pulled his shirt apart to show scars on his chest, then pushed his sleeves up to show a wicked scar that cut deep into his upper arm, biting into the muscle there.
Whether you be a trained warrior or an old lady, the skill of fighting lies not in what you can pick up, but in how much flesh you can carve and how well you will carve it, Tana. No one cares whether the person who does this is large, small, woman or man. Even the best dies suddenly on the battlefield. Death is death.
That was a true thing, but I held the axe out in my two hands. You want me to use this axe? Not a sword? Or a scimitar like you? Voidan tapped the hilt of his blade.
Do you have a sword? Have you suddenly come into money and can afford to buy one from someone here in the caravan?
No, I muttered.
Then, he said, it will be the axe, because it is what you have. I have held it while you were sleeping. It is well balanced, it is light and easy to wield. Hold it two-handed, just like when chopping wood. And remember, you hold a unique weapon.
He moved my hand up a little, and then the other down. A unique weapon? I asked.
Most men hold their shield with the left hand. With your axe, it is easy to switch it to a left-handed strike. Easier than learning to use a sword with your left. And you have a swing that comes easy to their unprotected side.
He held his shield up to demonstrate.
Swing slowly.
Like chopping at a tree from the left, I did, and I could see what he meant. He had to move aside to get the shield in front of him. I'm making you move around, I said.
You're controlling the fight from the first swing. There are other things you can do with the axe. For example, you can swing it past them and yank back, getting their neck with the downward-facing edge of the axe's point. You can stab at them with the upward point of the blade, spike them with the side away from the blade shaped so conveniently just like a spear point. Use the axe as a hook to sweep them off their feet.
There was more, and halfway through the slowly shown moves I stopped. You know a great deal about fighting with axes.
Boydan paused. It's a peasant's weapon, and my first.
Why do so few use it, then? I asked. Everyone has one. Voidan thought about it, as if for the first time. It's not the weapon of a warrior, but of the low peoples. It's for chopping trees and bramble, not flesh. That is what fighters say. Did the guards in Kaim work for their meals, or do nothing but soldier?
No,
I shook my head. They only soldiered. He grinned and warmed to the subject.
So, whether mercenaries or trained soldiers, it's the people who hold weapons who choose what they use the most, and they are not the same people who farm. So the axe isn't seen as a battle weapon.
I understood. And that is good for me.
Maybe,
Voidan shrugged. There are many unusual weapons on the field.
People who spend their lives smitten by particular weapons bring their preferred lover to the field of play. But it is not those small things that determine a battle. That is decided by things that take place long before foes meet.
I perked up.
Voidan commanded the fighting men of the caravan. It sounded like he had seen more combat than just scaring off bandits.
Like what?
It is how many soldiers are raised, he said. Your axe will do you no good against a well-aimed arrow, but an archer would have trouble escaping the jab of a sword, and so on.
It is the mix of weapons and people, and how many they wield.
It is how fresh they are, how healthy. Valor and intention are good for the heat of a battle, but if you are vastly outnumbered, there is only so much bravery can do.
I hefted the axe and thought about it.
Bravery while charging the four pikens had only gotten me beaten and left on the ground.
You need to win the battle before your first stroke.
Voidan grinned. Yes. And speaking of strokes, right there is a sapling we can take back for firewood for the cooks. Remember, chop from your left, the tree's right, to get past its shield.
What shield? I asked.
Voidan walked past me even as I said that and strapped his shield to a branch that jutted out enough to be used as a temporary arm. Get to it, he ordered. And I took on the small tree as if it were a raider, swinging past the shield and biting the axe into the meat of the sapling's bark over and over again until it toppled forward and Voidan yanked me out of the way. Never get so focused that you forget what else is around you, he said, as the trees struck the ground beside us. For 4 weeks, we continued, slow-moving practices against each other and fast ones when I faced more trees. Voidan carved a blunt axe out of wood for me and swaddled it with cloth, and then he made a light wooden scimitar padded just the same for himself. With these we dueled in the ever-thickening woods beside the caravan. The road began to slowly move back away from the coast, into the foothills. The ever-present smell of salt faded away, and we stopped passing seaside villages. Few towns existed here in the thick overgrowth, due to bramble. Only a few solitary homesteads fought back, alone, becoming trapped by the increasing thicket and bramble just miles north of the road. Occasionally, dim figures watched us go past from the shadows. Our guards fingered their arquebuses, but nothing happened. For a big man, Boyden moved damnably fast, constantly bruising my ribs and shoulders as we practiced, even slamming the padded scimitar down on my neck with swipes of his practice weapon. Every time he hit me, he'd tonelessly mutter, "Dead." But by the 4th week, he stopped saying that and moved on to maimed. After we fought, we'd run to catch back up to the caravan, sitting on the most rearward defense wagon, panting and catching our breaths. I slept in a bunking wagon, filled with slat beds mounted onto the walls. 10 women shared the tiny space, but I hardly knew them, even after 4 weeks, except for Anezka. She'd been there as I woke up from my bramble sleep and kept to my side, helping me understand the world of the wagons. When I had asked her why, she tapped the tattoos on her forearms. It's an investment. I always came to the wagon tired after Boydan's training. I would crawl right into my bunk and fall asleep. Voidan and his men never saw me weaken.
I'd worked among men in the butcher shops enough to know their minds, to know that to show weakness, tears, or anything other than humor and rage was to invite judgment. But alone in the bunks, when sleep failed me and I was alone with nothing more than the sounds of snoring women and the darkness that pressed against me, then I would sometimes surrender to tears as I thought about Set and Duram. Because of that, I feared being alone with my mind, so I trained every moment I could, worked every second I could bear. At first, the women in the bunking wagon did not speak to me, or even meet my eyes, until the oldest, a lady with a leathery weathered face, called Alka, asked if maybe I was fighting with Boydan, because I was not really a woman. "I bore 2 children that the Pykans took," I told her. "Torn from me like the old healer tore them from my body when they both refused to come easily. Would you have me expose myself to everyone in here to prove you wrong?" I grabbed the hems of my skirts to raise them. Alka shook her head quickly, scandalized, and the younger girls in the wagon laughed at her. "Of course she's a woman," Anezka shouted at them. "She is the executioness, remember? Not the executioner." I shook my head at Jarl's name for me. "Don't call me that," I asked. "I am just Tana." The women settled at Anezka's berating. Anezka was, I had found out, a quartermaster. The large mass of caravanners in the trailing edge provided the needs of the whole human train. Anezka and others like her handled accounting for supplies and kept the trade goods under lock and key. "There's the roadmaster," she had explained once, over a stewpot hanging from the balcony of the bunking wagon as we ate. "And then there's the quartermasters. We really run it all." The more I listened to the women chat in the wagon, the more I realized they were the grease that kept the caravan's wheels from seizing. And Anezka, with her silver-streaked dark hair, piercing dark eyes, and purple tattoos, was the shadow ruler of the whole caravan. There were questions and pieces of information constantly bandied around me between the bunks. Whose aurochs needed better feed? How fast was the caravan going? By the way, Anezka had noted a couple days ago, the flour was getting low. If they didn't get some barrels refilled, they'd run out in a week. All these things and more these women knew. Jarl directed the caravan, but my bunkmates made the caravan a living creature. And I was not one of them, though they all treated me with careful politeness. At the start of the 5th week, Boydan sent me out with Anezka and 3 other women for water, as one of the casks had sprung a leak.
"We are near a small river that runs beside the road," he said. "Keep a guard. It's a safe area, but be careful."
Up and down the caravan, flags whipped up onto small wooden masts at the rear of the wagons, giving the order to slow their pace. Anezka and her 3 companions pulled along a 2-wheeled cart that had 3 empty barrels on it. They laughed and joked as we moved down a narrow dirt path through the trees, out of sight of the caravan, and toward the babble of the tiny stream.
"I like to oversee where the water comes from," Anezka said. "Sometimes these 3 get timid and don't want to wade clear out to the center where it's freshest."
"It was just once," one of them protested.
"We all suffered for it for a week," Anezka said. She looked over at me. "Will you leave us when we get to Pyka?"
"Yes." I walked beside her, and I looked around the forest as she talked.
"That's a shame. You could spend forever in that strange city and never find someone," she said.
"You've seen it?" I asked.
"Right after I joined the caravan to see the world, and Jarl was negotiating the rights to travel in their territory," Anezka said. "Building on building, crammed into mazes of leaning streets. It's on a hill, and everything looks ready to fall over on top of everything else. And it goes on and on, from the foothills and up."
We reached the river, and I helped her pull a barrel from the wagon and roll it into the river with a splash. Anezka guided it to the center, her skirts knee-deep in the strong current. Well, if they are there to be found, I will find them. And if they are not to be found, then what? Anezka asked. I will kill the bastards that killed them, I said quietly. That is good, said one of the other women. You do what few of us can. Most of us lost families or our husbands to the Pykans. That's why we joined the caravan. What else were we to do? Anezka nodded. They cull us, or they take our youngest to large camps on some of the islands in their harbors and off the coasts, where we can never get to them. It's there that they teach them the Pykan ways and thoughts. Everyone nodded. Pykan ways. They're spreading, I said. Anezka stopped the barrel back up. I moved to help her roll it, but she pointed. 5 men had slipped out of the shadows of the trees on the opposite bank, hardly 20 feet from us. I hadn't noticed them. They held old rusty swords and were dressed in little more than rags. Realizing they had been seen, they splashed awkwardly across the hip-deep water at us, swords raised. I picked up my axe. Run for the caravan. But if they catch you, resist them any way you can, I shouted. I saw the grins on the men's faces as their splashing steps soaked their torn clothes. Go! So much for vengeance, I thought, my heart pounding. I would die slowing these attackers down enough so that Anezka and her friends could get to safety. Well, there were worse things to spend a life on. I only hoped my sons would forgive me. The men did not realize I'd picked up an axe. I let my body shield it from their view. Until they got close, I drew it from behind me and swung at the nearest man. His compatriots ran past us, leaving him alone to deal with me. I misjudged his running and missed. Although surprised and uncertain about my axe, he attacked. After blocking his swing, I slid the axe down the blade, then shoved it forward, puncturing his stomach with the spike at the top of the axe's curve. We both looked surprised that it had worked, and then I shoved him free to lie in the river, crying and groaning as his stomach spilled into the formerly clean river water. The 4 other men had caught themselves 4 struggling women and were laughing. I ran, almost tripping over my skirts, and raised my axe up into the air and buried it into the lower spine of the first man I caught up to. Anezka, pinned underneath, screamed loudly enough the 3 remaining men paused. They looked over as the man on top of her rolled off. He spasmed and gushed blood after I yanked the axe free to face our attackers. The 3 others shoved the women away and began to move at me. Boydan hadn't taught me how to take on 3 opponents at once. But he had taught me that a fight was won before the fight began. Digging deep inside, I calmed myself and met their gazes with a grin. It was an anticipatory grin, as if the first 2 men I had just killed were no more than an appetizer, and this was about to be a course I was looking forward to. Never mind that I'd killed 1 half of them because he expected no real resistance, and the other because his back was turned.
Who are you, lady? One bandit asked.
And Anezka stepped behind me.
Can't you tell by the damned blade? She cried out indignantly. This is the executioness!
They looked at the axe, and I wiped the blood from its edge with my thumb and tested the sharpness. When I looked back up at them, I saw I had won this battle, for there was fear there now.
The one who faced an entire party of Pykans? One of them asked. Yes, that one, Anezka said.
I walked forward, axe in hand, and the nearest man threw his sword at my feet.
I surrender my weapon, he said.
After a moment, the others did too. Pick up the swords, I ordered Anezka. She did, and handed them to the other women. "Run for the caravan," I whispered to her. "Get Boydan and some of his men, quick." "Yes," Anezka replied, wide-eyed, and then she spun and ran away. I turned back. Were there more men out in the woods? If I let these three go, would they come back for their revenge?